Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Today, we are privileged to have Dr. Herbert Chen of the University of Wisconsin, and he is going to discuss with us what it was like to train under both Dr. Sabison and Cameron, his experience editing the Annals of Surgery, and he will take us through the surgical management of hyperparathyroidism. But first, our opening shot.
Today we have Dr. Chen from University of Wisconsin talking to us about parathyroid disease. So we thought we'd start with this opening shot to just take us through a few of the basics. And really, these are the hot points that you're going to get pimped on rounds and on your ab site. So we just wanted to touch on it. So Jason, what are the genetic conditions that lead to parathyroid disease?
Yeah, so this is commonly tested, often shows up on the ab site. So you have the PRAD1 oncogene, which leads to increased parathyroid adenomas, as well as the MEN1 and MEN2A conditions, which is associated with hyperparathyroidism.
And so, John, you know, this is back in the step one days, but what are the symptoms of hyperparathyroidism? What's an easy way to remember it?
You know, the way I still remember, and I think how most people do, are the stones, bones, abdominal groans, the psychiatric overtones, mnemonic. And by stones, we mean kidney stones and polyuria. By bones, we mean osteitis, fibrosis, cystica, that would eventually lead to pathological fractures. Abdominal groans, we talk about constipation, indigestion, nausea, and vomiting, usually due to hypercalcemia. That can also lead to ulcers and pancreatitis. And then for the psychiatric overtones, we talk about a patient that looks fatigued, lethargic, depressed, will often complain of memory loss, or have symptoms of memory loss, ataxia, and delirium.
Yeah, so it's a pretty miserable disease, and it can be very subtle. And a lot of endocrine surgeons out there believe that this is a very much underdiagnosed disease. So heading that direction, Jason, how do you identify this disease, and how do you diagnose it?
Well, generally, the first thing you'll see is an elevated, incidental elevated calcium on a chemistry. You then check the PTH, which is inappropriately high for that level of calcium. One of the pathognomonic things, actually, that you can see on a basic metabolic panel is a chloride to phosphate ratio that's greater than 33:1. And this has to do with the effect of the excess parathyroid hormones effect on electrolyte regulation by the kidney.
So, John, will the urine in a patient with hyperparathyroidism have high or low levels of calcium?
Well, Kevin, if it is true hyperparathyroidism, the patients will have elevated urine calcium. If it is low, you want to consider familial hypercalcemic hypocalciuria, which is caused by a defective PTH receptor in the kidney. They will have normal or slightly high PTH and an elevated serum calcium, but rarely ever symptomatic. And these patients will always have a low urine calcium. And just remember that, you know, the treatment for this is definitely not a parathyroidectomy.
So, Jason, on the contrary, what if you have a patient and they have a high calcium and a low PTH?
Well, in these patients, you want to look for the actual parathyroid hormone-related peptide, which has the same effect as a parathyroid hormone. However, this is caused by an underlying malignancy such as breast cancer or a squamous cell cancer of the lung. With these, the urine will have high levels of cyclic AMP. However, you'll have high levels of cyclic AMP with hyperparathyroidism as well.
I imagine our lab can't run this test. Probably have to send that one out.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that one's a send out.
And so the whole diagnosis and the imaging is a controversial issue, which we'll talk about with Dr. Chen later. But with the experienced endocrine surgeon right now, the going is that you don't do a sestamibi scan unless it's for a reoperative disease. Generally, you can diagnose these and manage these with ultrasound. But John, so when do we operate on these patients? Does any patient with the high calcium, do we take them back to the operating room and take out all their parathyroids?
Well, I think the most significant indication for surgery is a patient that's symptomatic from those the symptoms we mentioned before, the stones, bones, abdominal groans, and psychiatric overtones. But also, if you have that patient who's asymptomatic, but will have a calcium greater than 13, decreased creatinine clearance, decreased bone mass, a 24-hour urine calcium that's greater than 400 milligrams, and if the patient is younger than 50 years old, are also indications for surgery.
Yeah, so those are good guidelines to kind of maybe start considering surgery in those patients. So, Jason, this topic is always
and just to be clear, there you'd consider surgery if any one of those is true, correct?
Right, correct. Yeah, definitely. And a lot of actually endocrinologists, and I think Dr. Chen talks about this later, though, is if they have a low threshold to take patients back with hyperparathyroidism, because even though they may have these, a lot of them are subclinical and they develop these problems over time. And so getting the disease taken care of early is for their benefit. But one thing I can never quite keep straight is the secondary and tertiary hyperparathyroidisms. Jason, can you break down secondary hyperparathyroidism for me?
Sure. So secondary hyperparathyroidism is you see these in patients who have renal failure, and their kidneys basically stop responding to the parathyroid hormone in the blood. So as a result, they have as part of the feedback loop, they have a higher level of parathyroid hormone in the blood. You'll also see this in patients who, for whatever reason, have a difficulty absorbing vitamin D from the gut.
I can't think of any of the patients at our hospital that have a problem with that.
Not at all. And what Kevin's alluding to is we're a very high volume bariatric center, so we often see a lot of these vitamin deficiencies in our patients.
Duodenal switch.
It's a great operation. And with these patients, you'll have a decreased calcium reabsorption in the kidney as a result of their kidney failure, and the kidneys are also unable to hydroxylate the vitamin D, so they have decreased calcium absorption in the gut as well. Secondary leads to low serum calciums and increased parathyroid hormone in the kidneys, are generally unable to secrete FOST, so they have a high phosphate level in the blood.
So, John, these patients come to you. Do we take their parathyroids out?
You know, Kevin, the vast majority of these patients do not need surgery. And the most common indications for surgery include refractory bone pain, pruritus, and then possibly pathologic fractures. When we do elect for surgery in these patients, we do a subtotal parathyroidectomy or a total parathyroidectomy with auto transplantation.
So, Jason, you have these patients that are coming with you, and they don't have those exact indications that need surgery. How are the endocrinologists and the medicine docs generally managing these patients?
So these patients are managed with vitamin supplementation, so calcium and vitamin D, and added to the diet, as well as phosphate binders such as Renagel, and even Tums to help them rid their body of the excess phosphate. In these patients, you can also administer a medication called Cinacalcet, which is a mimic of calcium and acts on the parathyroid to decrease the parathyroid hormone release.
So since we've gone down the rabbit hole of secondary hyperparathyroidism, John, I was hoping you can close the loop and just tell us what tertiary hyperparathyroidism is.
Sure, Kevin. These patients are patients usually have previously had secondary hyperparathyroidism and then received a kidney transplant. These patients will also have high parathyroid hormone as well as calcium, just like in normal hyperparathyroidism. And the treatment for these patients is a subtotal parathyroidectomy.
So in other words, they're so used to not having that negative feedback that their parathyroids get all amped up, and then you give them a fresh pair of kidneys and they can't turn the volume down, right?
Exactly. The very simplistic way of explaining that one.
And this is, at least when I was rounding as a med student, we always would get asked, how do you treat a hypercalcemic crisis? Jason, can you take us through the basics, at least the initial treatment of a hypercalcemic crisis?
Yeah, the initial treatment is, your first step is giving them fluids, giving them volume. And you need to give it at a pretty significant rate. Generally, you start at about 200 to 300 mLs an hour of normal saline. In these patients, things like you want to look at the medications that are on. So thiazides can worsen their hypercalcemia. And of course, lactated ringers it would be contraindicated given that it has calcium in it. After you start hydrating them, you can start trying to get rid of some of that calcium in their blood by using Lasix and as well as dialysis. These patients may actually need dialysis in order to lower their calcium levels.
Awesome. Well, we can't wait to hear from Dr. Chin to really fill us in with the surgical side of the house on managing hyperparathyroidism.
So, Kevin, for most parents, the sound of a crying baby is one of the worst sounds in the world. But did you know that there are some areas of the world where this is actually a good thing? Have you heard of this?
No, crying babies is a good thing. Never heard of it.
Not surprisingly, this occurs in Japan. There is an annual festival in which sumo wrestlers will hold babies in the air and try and scare them in order to induce them into crying. And parents not only sign their children up for this, they pay pretty good dollars in order for have the opportunity for their babies to participate in this. The festival is held annually, and sumo wrestlers hold babies in the air to see which cries the loudest and the loudest and for the longest amount of time. It's a competition. Should the babies choose not to participate, a referee then enters the arena and attempts to scare them into it by wearing traditional mask and making loud noises. The ritual is said to be cathartic for the babies, bringing good health and as well as warding off evil spirits.
I bet there's some interesting YouTube videos of those.
There are actually some awesome YouTube videos of it, and I encourage anybody out there to just Google Japan sumo wrestler crying baby. This festival coincides with Japan's annual Children's Day. And there you go. Who knew it? There's actually some pretty good pictures of of the baby who got first place just in looking terrible, crying his head off on the internet. So that has been your Ren Fact of the Day.
So welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. We are absolutely pleased to have Dr. Herbert Chin, who is the Professor Layton F. Rickards Chair in Surgical Leadership and also the Chairman of the Division of General Surgery, the Vice Chairman of Research in the Department of Surgery and the Section of Endocrine Surgery at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Dr. Chin, we cannot thank you enough, and welcome to Behind the Knife.
Thank you very much for having me.
So for those who don't know as much about your background, can you give us a little bit of background where you're from, Marshfield, Wisconsin, Go Badgers, and a little bit about where you trained and how you wound up at University of Wisconsin?
Sure. So I grew up in Marshfield, Wisconsin, as you said, and after that I went. I attended undergraduate at Stanford and then went east where I was at Duke Medical School. And after completing my medical school at Duke, I went to Johns Hopkins where I did surgical residency. I did a research fellowship, and then I did a surgical oncology fellowship at Hopkins. And I took my first job here at the University of Wisconsin. It's the job I am currently in as well.
So were you? Did you train under both Dr. Savastin and Dr. Cameron?
Yeah, no, I did. So I had a great fortune of being a medical student with David Savastin and then a surgical resident under John Cameron.
So how would you compare and contrast the two? We've been lucky enough to have a wonderful conversation with Dr. Cameron earlier on Behind the Knife episode. So any thoughts or any vivid memories about some experiences with either one or both?
I would say, like I alluded to, I was very fortunate to just be, I think, at the right place at the right time. I think both of they're similar in many ways, that both giants in American surgery, both had made significant contributions to both clinical practice, research, and education. But I think if both of them would want you to if they had to select probably their most important accomplishments would focus around education, training the next generation. So when I was a medical student under Dr. Sabston, that was just an incredible experience because when you went on the surgical rotation, he spent, he had a teaching conference with the third year medical students every week. And he would call you by, he'd say, Mr. Chen, Mr. So-and-so, ask you questions. And then once once a year, Dr. Sabston had the entire class at his home. And although you'd come, if you could bring a guest, you'd be wearing a name tag. But Dr. Sabston, just an incredible memory. He would go around, he would physically talk to each of the medical students who'd been invited, and he would say something about you that obviously told you that he had taken the time to learn something about you. So, for example, he would come up to me and say, you know, Mr. Chen, it's so nice you're here. Did you really like Stanford, or how was it growing up in Wisconsin? So he would remember something about each individual person. Mm-hmm. And would and definitely when you were on the rotation, it was clear that a priority when you were on the rotation was medical education. He participated in it. And so that was just an amazing experience to see the chair of surgery so committed to your educational experience as a medical student, and I think that inspired a lot of people to pursue surgery. Now, it was a very similar situation when I showed up then at Hopkins under John Cameron. I remember the first day walking into orientation and with a whole set of interns, and at that time all the surgical subspecialties did an internship, so orthopedics, ENT, as well as general surgeons. And Dr. Cameron would present us each with the Halsted tie, and we didn't have name tags, so we went around calling everyone, you know, by their name and giving them your tie and saying something about you as well. And that's how it started, but Dr. Cameron also had an amazing commitment to education. We had what was called Sunday school with him, so every Sunday morning we'd spend an hour and a half to 2 hours, the residents and the medical students, and he would take the time to teach at that point, and obviously teach during when you saw him on the service. And then as you progressed as a resident to sort of the finishing year when you were the super chief, you'd operate with him every day when you were for about a third of the year. And he really is an outstanding teacher in the operating room because he demanded excellence from you, and he would have the patience, and which I think is really unbelievable, as he'd be doing you'd be doing a Whipple operation with him, and we'd be a big believer in hand sewing, and you'd be throwing well over 100 stitches. And he would watch the placement of every single one. And if you put one wrong, he would tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
But just an amazing demanded excellence from you and really pushed you to be the best that you could be.
Sir, I've seen that you're a very prolific basic science and clinical researcher, but you're also a very busy clinical practice. How have you gone about this, and what philosophy do you take with research in clinical practice?
Well, I think that when you one of the greatest things about being a surgeon is you have the ability to do so. There are many different options. Obviously, we can help a patient out by operating on them and curing disease. You can contribute by discovery in the laboratory or doing other types of research that affect a whole bunch of patients, and of course, teaching. And I think striking the balance between all of those things that you definitely want to do can be challenging at times. So I'm a big fan about trying to optimize your efficiency, to manage your schedule and plan ahead. So some of the basic, I guess, principles about trying to achieve balance like that. So it really is helpful if your research is well integrated with your clinical practice. And I think that if you segment things in your schedule, so typically like I have, I operate right now, how my schedule is I operate 2 days and I do a half day clinic, and I try to keep all my clinical activities focused on those days, leaving the other time to focus on my research. Obviously, having a good team is very important. So I have a great team of work with a great team of nurses, nurse practitioners, and other surgeons for the clinical practice, and then a great team in the lab that I meet with quite often. And then I think is communicating well, obviously, is important when you're trying to juggle, manage a team of individuals, letting them know what the game plan is and updating them when things happen. But I think that it's certainly, although more challenging today, to try to balance all the demands that you have from a clinical standpoint, research standpoint, teaching, still very doable and still, I think, very rewarding.
Kind of along those same lines, looking at your researching funding, it's incredible. NIH, NIH, NCI, American Cancer Society, a mixture of some private ones and also, you know, maybe a little bit of industry. In this era where you have diminishing funding, how do you manage to keep it up? And what advice do you give there to junior researchers out there in terms of pursuing this? Do you have any tips to be able to do in addition to just work hard and resubmit and take things? How do you manage to get all this funding?
Well, so when I have a talk that I give when I'm ever asked to be a visiting professor, I think it's one of the more popular ones that people ask for, and it's the title is Top 10 Strategies for Success in Academic Surgery. And a lot of that is based upon the stuff that I've done with the Association for Academic Surgery, and some of it based on experience and what other people have given me advice. But I think for you know, obtaining funding, I use an analogy as I compare a funded grant to like a home run. And that I use the analogy, if you look at the leaders in home run leaders in Major League Baseball, they are also the strikeout leaders because they're swinging hard, trying to go for the big home run, and by doing so, they're going to strike out many more times than they hit the home run. So if you look at, on average, they strike out 5 times for every 1 time they hit a home run. And I think that's the way you have to be when you apply for a grant. You've got to take a lot of swings. You've got to step up to the plate and swing hard every time, and realizing that most of the time, you're going to miss the ball. And I think and this not only applies to surgeons, but it applies to anyone who wants to develop a funded research program, you're going to strike out so many times, and you just have to realize that's what everyone does. And then when you do strike out or fail, you then have to turn around and address the concerns people have in the grant and not to take it personally, and then just resubmit it. And I think you just have to, I know it's a little cliche-ish about saying you just got to keep on trying and trying, but I think that people get discouraged, I think, too easily when they have an unsuccessful attempt. And one of my favorite quotes is from Winston Churchill, success is going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. And I think that's the way it is with grant writing. You just have to keep on trying and trying and be willing to take, to strike out so many times to get that one home run. And so I think that is one of the most important things. And then the other thing I would say is that you have to, in the area right now where more and more emphasis on team science, you have to be a great collaborator and work with individuals and build teams that study questions as opposed to individuals.
In addition to your research, you're also an associate editor for Annals of Surgery. How has that been, and how much time does that take, and what did it take to get to there?
It takes more time than I thought it would, to tell you the truth. And it's a really, just before I got on this call, I was managing 5 new manuscripts that were sent in. I really enjoy it because it allows me to see what people are doing. It allows me to get a good picture of the surgical science that's going on, and allows me to have some type of impact on the field that is selecting what perhaps is going to be the work that is recognized and published in Annals of Surgery, which is right now the highest ranked surgical journal there is. I was very fortunate to have an opportunity to be involved with the journal initially because when I came on faculty at Wisconsin, the editor was Leighton or Bing Rickers, the person whose chair I hold right now. And so he involved me in reviewing papers for the journal and even asked me to write an editorial once. And I think what I always say to new faculty members or young faculty members is that if that's something you're interested in doing and working with editorial boards, that first of all, it starts by reviewing for that journal, and it starts by asking the associate editor to send you some papers to learn how to do it and do it well and do it on time, just like any task you're given. And eventually, if you do a good job, you may be asked, like I was after reviewing for the journal for many, many years, when the leadership changed over from Bing Rickers to Keith Lillimo, and Keith decided to expand the number of associate editors, he asked if I would do it because I've done a lot of review for Annals and done them well and knew I was committed to making sure that there was excellence at the journal and therefore had the opportunity. And I think a lot, just like many opportunities in life, they come from you creating an opportunity and perhaps others helping you get that initial foot in the door opportunity, and then just doing the best job possible with enthusiasm. And I think that eventually gets recognized.
Okay, now it's time for our dissection of the day. We are again pleased to have Dr. Herbert Chen from the University of Wisconsin, who is an expert specialist in endocrine surgery. And Dr. Chen, would like you to walk us a little bit through. We're going to focus on hyperparathyroidism. So first of all, you got a patient that's referred to you with possible hyperparathyroidism. What is your preferred, if it hasn't been already, kind of the localizing studies, the labs you like to get, and how do you go about thinking about these patients in preparation for the operating room?
Sure. And so what I tell the residents and fellows when we're in clinic seeing patients with potential hyperparathyroidism, obviously, the first step is making a diagnosis, and the diagnosis of hyperparathyroidism is a biochemical diagnosis. That is, patients will have an elevated calcium, an inappropriately high normal, or just frankly elevated parathyroid hormone level. And so that is what I use for the diagnosis. Now, there can be other things that support the diagnosis, including, an elevated or high normal urine calcium. But in general, that is the diagnosis, elevated calcium, elevated PTH. And once you make the biochemical diagnosis, then the decision is, are you going to intervene? And right now, the only curative therapy is surgery. And we are pretty liberal in my practice that I think the diagnosis of a hyperparathyroidism is an indication for surgery, meaning that there is a lot of data that says right now that patients with hyperparathyroidism benefit from surgery or benefit from intervention. Now, there are published criteria out there to suggest when you should operate or when it's best, which a lot of people follow, but I still think that the guidelines are too strict and I think all patients with hyperparathyroidism should be referred for a surgeon for consideration of parathyroidectomy. Now, having made the diagnosis, and made the decision to operate, that's when you decide whether or not to get a localization scan. I think too many times people utilize a localization scan to determine if the patient is going to have the surgery. And what I and my partners I think the majority of endocrine surgeons believe is that localization scans should only be obtained if you've decided to intervene. And if you decided to operate, one would say, and I think there's a famous quotation from John Dottman, who was a radiologist, that the best localization study for hyperparathyroidism is a good parathyroid surgeon. So in some cases, you don't need to do imaging at all. In certain cases, especially for secondary and tertiary hyperparathyroidism, where you expect multi-gland disease, there's no need to do any localization. And that would even apply for patients with primary hyperparathyroidism, which you think they are multi-gland disease. So patients with familial hyperparathyroidism, MEN1, no need for localization. I think the decision becomes harder if you have a patient with sporadic primary hyperparathyroidism. Should you localize? Should you not? My current practice is, as I talk to the patient, and most of the times we won't do localization scans. I think if you're going to do a localization scan, usually my choice is to do ultrasound or cystectomy first. Now, with patients who have recurrent hyperparathyroidism, I would always insist on a localization scan, and usually for that I would do a 4D CT scan. But for the patient who's never been explored or never had surgery before on their neck, I'm quite comfortable not doing localization or doing usually a cystectomy scan. And then depending on what the localization shows, if it's negative, like I said, the localization scan should never be utilized to decide if you operate. We're going to operate, and usually we'll end up doing what we call a bilateral exploration. But if the imaging scans suggest a focus on one side, we will start with a focused operation.
Great, and that leads just into what we were hoping to talk about next, is what is your general surgical management of these patients? When you're doing these focused surgical excisions, are you still looking at the other side, or are you just checking the PTH level and getting out of there? And how does the intraoperative PTH assays work? What's the practical use of those?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think everyone does it a little differently, but I can just tell you my approach is that there's one technique that I utilize and we utilize here in our practice that is not widely utilized, and that's the radio-guided gamma probe. So we, on the day of surgery, we inject patients with 10 millicuries of cystectomy, and we take them to the operating room. We get no scan on that day, and we use the probe to help us determine if it's going to be single-gland or multi-gland disease. So let's say we're going in on a patient who we strongly believe has an adenoma, and let's say we have an imaging study which suggests it's on the right side. So what I would do is I would do a transverse, a midline incision, make it right in the middle, usually about 2.5 centimeters in size, and I would look at the right side, and let's say there happens to be what looks like an adenoma in the right upper area. I would take it out, and we then measure the amount of radioactivity on that gland. And what we do is we take a read with the gamma probe of the background radiation on the thyroid isthmus. So usually that number is around 200. And then when you take the ex vivo count of that resected parathyroid gland on the probe, if it's greater than 20% of the background, so if the background's 200, 20% would be 40, that's definitely an abnormal parathyroid gland. The higher the count in general, that suggests a higher chance of an adenoma. So we would then take that gland out, and then we would do parathyroid hormone monitoring. And we typically draw an intraoperative parathyroid hormone level. What we call the baseline is usually right after the patient goes to sleep, and then we check at 5, 10, and 15 minutes after that adenoma is removed. And then if it falls by 50% at any of those time points, we generally terminate the operation. If the PTH level does not fall by 15 minutes by 50%, then we would begin to examine the rest of the glands. Now, sometimes when you're in there and you've taken out one enlarged gland, and although it's abnormal, but you suspect there might be more glands, we may take a peek at the gland, the ipsilateral gland, and if that looks funny, then even before PTH comes back, we would then go and look at the other side. So a lot of this is nuance of what you find in the operating room and what your belief is the chance of there being a multi-gland disease. And there are different ways you can sort of hedge that bet a little bit, that if the patient's labs are not that high, it generally tends to be multi-gland disease. If you've taken out a gland and it's really not that big and looks more like a hyperplastic gland, then they decide and push you to go ahead and look at the other side. So there are a lot of judgment things that you utilize, or that at least I do in the operating room, to decide when we're going to just stay looking at one side or look at both sides.
Can you talk a little bit about your views on minimally invasive parathyroidectomy, yeah, robotic, approach to the neck? I mean, is this where everything's headed, or is this just something for select cases, or are you not a believer? What are your thoughts overall on this trend?
So I think it depends on how you define minimally invasive parathyroidectomy. I think if you ask someone what minimally invasive parathyroidectomy is, you ask a group of surgeons, you may get 10 or 20 different answers. So my definition of minimally invasive parathyroidectomy is a focused approach where you target one gland and you remove that gland without disturbing the rest of the glands. Now, some people call minimally invasive operations just defined by how big the incision is. But truthfully, you can, in most patients, you can do a focused approach or a bilateral approach through about the same size incision. So I'm not sure that necessarily is a good definition of a minimally invasive procedure. But So I believe it is a concept of just targeting one gland. Now, there are different ways to access the neck. And so I would say my preference is still to do that 2.5 to 3 centimeter incision for all patients with hyperparathyroidism. But others have come up with techniques where they make an incision that big and maybe they put in a laparoscope, and that's called video-assisted parathyroidectomy. So I think or minimally invasive video-assisted, which is a little misleading, I think, because what we're doing is we're doing the operation I would normally do through the small incision, but we're just putting a laparoscope in. So, I mean, that doesn't really make it more minimally invasive. But there are other remote access procedures where we can approach either parathyroids or probably more commonly for thyroidectomy through approaches through the axilla, through the breast, through the back of the ear, and so there are a lot of ways you can get to those organs in the neck. Now, for me, it's like if you were driving a car home, you would take the shortest route, and the shortest route to the parathyroid is to make an incision in the neck where it's just right underneath there. So I think that some of these remote access techniques, you know, sound a little crazy, and I think some of them are. Because in the end, what they're doing is they're taking the longer route home in order to save a scar. Now, the scar from a parathyroid operation is very small and sometimes not even noticeable with time. So I think a lot of these approaches make absolutely no sense for the parathyroid itself. Now, one would argue to resect the thyroid, the incision has to be a little bigger, maybe 3 or 4 centimeters. But still, you're talking about a 3 or 4 centimeter incision in the neck versus a 7 or 8 centimeter incision in the axilla or behind the ear or multiple incisions in the breast and chest, which I think to a lot of people sound crazy. But sort of interestingly, we did this, one of our fellows, Huggy Mazet, did this study where he surveyed people. And this is talking about thyroid, so this is going a little off the topic, but this is on the use of remote access or robotic thyroidectomy where you kill from the axilla. So what Huggy did is he took a survey, and he went to one of our malls here and just asked random people there, you know, if you had to choose, if you had to have your thyroid out, what would you choose to have an incision in your neck or an incision in your axilla? And shockingly, I mean, I guess, so obviously these are just patients who don't have thyroid disease who are in a mall. The majority said they would have it through the axilla. And on top of that, changed the question, so if you were going to have the axilla, what operative, would you be willing to accept a higher operative risk? And it's amazing, patients would, I can't remember the exact number, but it's like, I think it was about a 5 times higher operative risk to have it through the axilla, which I was just like, I couldn't believe. But that just goes to show, I guess, that obviously what we think is a small incision, maybe there is some interpretation by the lay people that the cosmetic result of an incision in the neck is you know, not desirable. But I just know from my seeing my patients in clinic, one of our surgeons does do a remote access procedure, but we cannot sell anyone on it. So still, all our surgery is done through the neck. And I think that, so going back to parathyroid, I think it's crazy to think of anything other than the straight neck approach for parathyroid. And there may be a role for some of these remote access for the thyroid, but I think just in very select cases, because you're trading cosmesis for a potentially higher morbidity, and you could even, when you're doing these procedures remotely, you could end up, if you get in the trouble, you could have to make an incision in the neck. So you could be the worst thing of both worlds. You end up with two incisions, now one in the neck and one in the axilla or wherever you go. So anyway, I have a biased opinion, and so my bias is that there's probably no role for the robot or minimally invasive access procedures.
So we just published our episodes from the American Transplant Congress, and that kind of leads into secondary and tertiary hyperparathyroidism. What are the surgical options for these patients?
Yeah, so I think that surgeons, today we see less and less secondary and tertiary hyperparathyroidism. Now, secondary hyperparathyroidism, which effectively could be on any patient who is dialysis-dependent or has malabsorption, probably has some degree of secondary. And most of the time, secondary hyperparathyroidism can be managed medically by calcium replacement and other techniques. So I think where surgeons tend to have a role in is that either secondary patients who have failed medical management, which is the minority, or patients after renal transplantation who develop tertiary hyperparathyroidism. Now, it's very fitting that you're asking me this question because we just presented a paper at the American Surgical this year looking at the utilization of surgery for tertiary hyperparathyroidism. And as it turns out, there was this common belief that if you gave a patient a kidney transplant, it would essentially cure the hyperparathyroidism in the majority of people. And the published literature says about 95% of patients will be cured, and the tertiary hyperparathyroidism really only develops in 5% of transplant patients. But when we looked at our series here using a large transplant database in Wisconsin, that percentage is much higher, and it's probably well over 5%, depending on how you define it, and maybe even 40 or 50% of patients after renal transplantation have tertiary hyperparathyroidism. And we've shown also, as part of that study, whereas, again, the only curative therapy for tertiary hyperparathyroidism is surgery, and the only really approved therapy for tertiary hyperparathyroidism is the surgery. However, the majority of patients are not referred for surgery anymore. And what's striking, in the last year of our study, no patients were referred for surgery because a lot of them get treated with cinacalcet or Sensipar, which is utilized for patients with secondary and really not approved for patients after renal transplant, but still widely utilized by nephrologists and people in the transplant community. So we're trying to rebut some of that practice by getting the knowledge out that this shouldn't be, and that surgery should be used more often. And there is this misbelief that if you do parathyroidectomy on the patient after renal transplantation, that compromises their renal function. So we just, in our paper, just showed that's totally not true. In fact, the patients who have parathyroidectomy tend to have a longer graft survival than those that don't. So that's just my speech about, I think parathyroidectomy is underutilized. Now, if you're talking about surgery for tertiary hyperparathyroidism, the operation of choice is, I think, a subtotal parathyroidectomy, because those patients almost universally have four enlarged glands. There's no need to do any localization, and that you do a 3.5 gland parathyroidectomy, and the vast majority will be cured with that procedure. And we do that through a fairly small incision. We examine all the glands. We try to leave half of the most normal gland. We take the three other out. Usually we can do it in an outpatient procedure as well. So, and the morbidity is very low with that operation.
And how does that operation differ from the patient with parathyroid hyperplasia?
Yeah, so what... So how we would treat a patient with parathyroid hyperplasia due to primary hyperparathyroidism, and let's say it's not MEN1-associated, just a sporadic hyperplasia, and that of a patient with tertiary hyperparathyroidism is essentially the same operation. And sort of the rationale of why we do that operation for both, especially if, you know, focusing on the tertiary hyperparathyroidism, is the reason they developed hyperparathyroidism in the tertiary state is that their glands were enlarged, became enlarged when they were in renal failure, and that the transplant, the glands didn't shrink. But as long as their transplant works, there should be no stimulus for any of the parathyroid tissue to grow anymore. So if you do a subtotal parathyroidectomy, leaving part of the gland in the neck, your remnant should function fine because you've left it on its natural vascular pedicle, and that the chance of recurrence should be fairly low as long as the graft works. And I think that is a, so why is that operation preferred? Because the other option would be to do a total parathyroidectomy and transplant part of that, one of the parathyroids of the arm. The downside about that operation is that you have no parathyroid tissue for a period of time because you're waiting for the transplant to work, so you need to take calcium and calcitriol. And then if the graft doesn't work, you may have to implant more or it might not be right. And that's why we generally don't do that as the first operation for tertiary or in a sporadic hyperplasia. Again, we do the subtotal, and only a subsegment of patients who then develop recurrent disease do we then take that remnant out and implant it in the arm. But we don't have to do that that often.
Okay, so now it's time for our tips and tricks segment. This is when we ask our experts to give us those helpful hints to get us out of those sticky situations. And Dr. Chen, I'm going to pose three different scenarios that I'd like you to address. And it's dealing with a difficult neck. And the first way is, do you have any tips in terms of getting in on the scarred-in neck that's been done before? You've taken out a gland, and now it's time to take out the other half of the gland. Second, how do you, along those lines, identify the landmarks, specifically the vascular structure and the recurrent laryngeal nerve to avoid damage or to get adequate access for ligation on the vasculature? And then third, how do you handle the big goiter, the one that extends down below the sternum or down below the sternal notch and into the lower sternum? What tips do you have for those situations? Getting in, identifying the landmarks and the appropriate anatomy, and then that big goiter that may be substernal.
Oh, all three difficult situations. So for the first one, when you're talking about going in on a reoperative neck, I think there are a few tricks, and I think these are, you know, these are no secrets of mine, but what I was taught by my mentors. And that, so I think you have to think ahead from the first operation. And why I say that is that, in general, there are two operations you should do when you're thinking of thyroidectomy. You should either take half out or all of it out, or essentially a lobectomy or total thyroidectomy. And the rationale is, if you're going to operate on one side of the neck, you should get the lobe out so you never have to go back there to take thyroid tissue out, because going back in on the same side where you've been is a pain, because as you hinted at, the planes are scarred in, the whatever tissue's left is potentially stuck to the nerve, you don't see the parathyroids. So you have to think ahead, and so if you're smart, you take out that whole lobe so you'll never have to go back. So in general, most of the time when we're going back, it's because we've taken out a lobe and we have to take out the other lobe. So when we go back in, I generally don't go back. If I can go back within 2 weeks, I'll do it, but usually it's not within 2 weeks, and then I usually wait 6 to 8 weeks to let the scar tissue down. And then when you go back in, the scar tissue is in the superficial planes, but because you've not touched the other side, when you go to resect the lobe, there's no scar tissue once you get in under the straps, and then the dissection is similar to a new neck, which I think is the practice. So if you stick to that practice of taking out one side when you're on that side, you won't be in the situation you have to go back. Now, occasionally you do have to go back in on the same side. And that, for instance, if you take out a parathyroid on that side once and all of a sudden you develop, you know, thyroid cancer, you need to take the thyroid on that side, or vice versa, you've taken the thyroid out, now you have to take a parathyroid out on that side. So in those instances, my approach is usually the first time I go in, I go central. I split the straps in the middle, go underneath, and approach whatever gland I'm going for from medial to lateral. But in the reoperative situation, what can be helpful if you you can approach lateral to medial, that is you can still make your go over the old incision, split the sternohyoid muscles in the middle, and then instead of trying to split the sternothyroid in the middle, which may be stuck, go around to the lateral side and retract the sternothyroid muscle medially, the sternohyoid laterally, and come at the gland from lateral. So I think that's a good trick to getting access. As far as identifying the nerve, some people use the nerve monitor. I do not believe in the nerve monitor. And the reason I don't believe in it is because there's no, in randomized prospective trials, they have demonstrated that it does not prevent nerve injury. So the use of the nerve monitor does not prevent nerve injury and hasn't been associated with better outcomes. I think an experienced surgeon can find the nerve, and that's, so during a routine thyroid operation, I identify the nerve and dissect it along its entire course before I start dividing vascular structures. You can do that even in a reoperative situation, except it may be harder. I usually try to identify the nerve up high where it inserts into cricoid thyroid and then work down. But if you're in a scarred neck, you usually have to start very low. So you're going to start your section very low in an undissected plane. So it may be very low in the neck. You find the nerve when it's a little more lateral, and you trace it up into the scar tissue and carefully dissect it out. So that is one trick that I utilize to find the nerve when it's difficult, and I think that that generally can happen in almost all cases, is to go to find an area which hasn't been dissected out to identify the critical nerve and follow it up. And then I think your last question focused on the difficult goiter, and I think there are some tricks that you can utilize for that as well. And I think, first of all, is that they often look much worse than they are, and so you see this massive goiter on imaging, and you're thinking, there's no way I can remove that through the neck. And in the vast majority of cases, you can remove that through cervical incision. When we've looked at our substernal goiter experience, the vast majority, and I'm saying well over 90%, can be resected through a cervical incision. So in that case, when I'm approaching a goiter, it's a little, that's substernal. I approach a little differently than a regular thyroidectomy, because usually my a regular straightforward thyroid incision, I make the incision about one finger breadth below the cricoid cartilage. But if I'm doing a substernal goiter, I will make that incision lower to give me access. And I think the trick is then when you then get down to trying to mobilize the goiter from beneath the sternum or beneath the clavicle, a lot of people utilize tricks. I think that, and utilize different instruments. So on our tray, we have the goiter spoon, which incidentally is a spoon from our cafeteria here, which has been sterilized, which we often utilize to help scoop up the goiter from the mediastinum. And so that's difficult to describe how we use the spoon, but that's one technique we utilize. The other thing people will do is that they often put sutures into the thyroid and almost fish it out. Is generally pull some tension on the suture and then get a bite lower, and so I've seen that and my partners do that. But usually what you can do is that if you can then, I use a harmonic scalpel when I take out thyroid, so if you can take the vascular attachments with the harmonic scalpel and gradually ease down on the gland until you can take all the vascular structures at the tip, you can generally mobilize that out without any difficulty, I mean, with some difficulty, I should say. But I think the trick is often to, it will often involve you using some type of instrument to get down low to mobilize it up. And I think the goiters that are mostly in the neck usually are not that. You just have to make a little bigger incision.
Well, that ends our tips and tricks segment on the difficult recurrent neck and identifying landmarks in the large goiter.
And this leads us into our final segment of today, the final five. This is where we get to know
our surgeons just a little bit better. So, sir, we're going to start off with number one. Do you listen to music in the operating room? And if so, what type of music?
So we do listen to music in the operating room, and I actually allow whoever's operating with me or the nurses to choose what type of music because I'm pretty flexible in what we listen to. I will often ask them to play what their favorite is so I can learn something about them.
Now, but if you're getting to make the call, what are you putting on the dial?
Oh, I would probably, if I was making the call, I'd probably put Maroon 5.
I'm a big Adam Levine fan myself.
Yeah, but again, I like to hear a variety of music, and that's why I often ask the other people to put it on, because I'm always interested in learning about new things and new types of new songs that I've never heard.
Number two, do you have any hidden talents, any hobbies, or any interests outside of the operating room, outside of surgery, that you can tell us about?
I'm not sure there are any hidden talents. There's a lot of things that I like to do outside the operating room and outside of work. I think if you ask people that know me, they know that I'm an avid golfer. I am an avid skier, both water and snow, play tennis. So I'm into doing a lot of different activities.
Did you ever play Dr. Cameron in golf?
I just played Dr. Cameron last Saturday in golf, in fact.
I happened
to be at the with the old hands, which is the reunion of the Hopkins residents, and we got to play golf together.
So he told us that Saturday he plays with his residents and Sunday he plays with his family. So was this Saturday that you played?
This was Saturday morning that I played with them. And it was the second time I got to play with them. And as you might imagine, he has a very consistent game. It's always straight.
That's fantastic.
So you got to tell us, what'd you score and what he scored? Who won? I mean, we cannot
let
that.
So if you're going to bet, first of all, if you're going to bet on golf, and I'm one of the person, you should always bet against me because I underperform on the golf course. But and you should always bet on John Cameron, who's very, very consistent. Hits it always in the middle and is extremely accurate and extremely patient. On that day, I'm just trying to think, he definitely beat my score. And he was definitely in the 80s and maybe even the low 80s, and I was in the high 80s. So, but the two times I played with him, the score has been virtually identical. It's very consistent.
And number three, do you have a favorite trip or vacation you could tell us about?
So based on what I just told you about the things I like to do, so there are a couple trips that I look forward to every year. But I love to travel. I love to see other surgeons in other countries and see what they do. So I've been very fortunate to have the chance to travel abroad a lot during my career to see how they do surgery in other places, and I've learned a lot. But for pure vacation, so I like to do unique things. So I can't really say that one place geographically, but I've loved almost all the places I've gone, but I'll say that the three vacations I look forward to, which are my regular ones every year, is my wife and I do a ski trip, typically to Beaver Creek, which we love to ski. We do a family beach trip to Topsail Beach, North Carolina. We've been doing that for over 20 years, and we look forward to that. And the third is my guys' trip. We have an annual golf outing, 24 guys. We go to a different place every time. We're going to Pebble Beach this year. Last year we were at Kiowa. We've been to Pinehurst, Kohler. So it's a great group of guys, and we go every September. So those are my three favorite trips every year.
Number four, if you did not go into surgery, what would have been an alternate career that you would have chosen?
Well, I think because of I do research, it might have been to be a scientist instead of a surgeon scientist. But are you saying a non-medical or could it be medical?
Yeah, it could be non-medical. Let's focus on that. Let's say outside of medicine, you had to choose something else you were going to do.
Well, I think that the two things, one, it might have been a scientist, because that is partly what I do, but if it wasn't that, I probably would have explored business and something to do with management or leadership, because I find that that's something that I have always enjoyed throughout my career, and that's something I definitely enjoy now.
Okay, our final question, number five. If you could go back in time and meet yourself as an intern, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
Well, I would say that, you know, when I was an intern, I was just trying to survive and learn everything I could, and I would not have, I've been very fortunate. I've trained with some tremendous people. I've had great friends and colleagues. I've been great opportunities in my career, so I feel very, very fortunate where I am right now, and I would have not, if you told me as an intern that I would be doing what I'm doing now, I would have never guessed, because I guess I didn't think that all these things that have happened to me would have happened. And part of it is at that time I was, I guess I didn't think as far as I do now as about life as I, you know, when we're young as an intern, we're just, I think many people just think about what the next day is going to be or how you're going to get through. But perhaps I would, some advice I would give myself is that to, I didn't really think long term of where I wanted to be or what I wanted to do, or, so I might have told myself to at least think a little forward. And I think that one thing we don't realize that when you're going through, which I would have, I would tell myself, is that, you know, we're all very fortunate to have the opportunity to do what we do, to train, to do the things we do at work, and a lot of that is because you have a great support network, and especially, you know, I've been married for a long time, and I was married when I was a resident. Certainly my spouse supported me a lot, and I think back and going through that, and I don't think I was always appreciative of that fact, and I know that, and I see this occasionally, that when you are training and working hard and someone supporting you, you may not always be appreciative of that at the time because you yourself are tired. And I've heard like some residents get into arguments with their spouse and say, well, I'm saving lives every day. What are you doing? But I think that's obviously a huge mistake, because you have to realize is that the only reason you're able to do what you do is because someone else is taking care of you at home, or making sure all the stuff that gets done. So I would go back and tell myself to really think about, obviously, the great opportunity, but always to keep in check that you have someone that is really supporting you to do this, and to express, I think we could all express a little more appreciation for that more regularly than we do.
Well, Dr. Chen, we can't thank you enough for taking the time out to join us on Behind the Knife. It's been absolutely fantastic conversation. Again, I seem like I always say this, but I know I learned a lot just from sitting here and listening to you and taking your words of wisdom. And we hope that sometime in the future you'd be able to join us again.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. I thank you for including me.
Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Sash is closed, and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.